thought out. Connection. Most people think first of what they want to express or make, then find the audience for their idea. You must work the opposite angle, thinking first of the public. You need to keep your focus on their changing needs, the trends that are washing through them. Beginning with their demand, you create the appropriate supply. Do not be afraid of people's criticism. Without such feedback, your work will be too personal and delusional. You must maintain as close a relationship to your environment as possible, getting an inside feel for what is happening around you. Never lose touch with your base.
Hood Economics. The following is a quote from Malcolm X. I knew that the ghetto people knew that I never left the ghetto in spirit, and I never left it physically any more than I had to. I had a ghetto instinct. For instance, I could feel if tension was beyond normal in a ghetto audience, and I could speak and understand the ghetto's language. Starting out as a drug dealer at the age of 12, Curtis Jackson faced an unfamiliar world that contained all kinds of dangers. The business side of hustling was relatively easy to figure out. It was the people, the various actors in the game, the rival hustlers, the big-time dealers, the police, who could be tricky. But strangest and most impenetrable of all was the world of the drug users themselves, the clientele upon which his business depended. Their behavior could be erratic, and even downright frightening. With rival hustlers and the police, Curtis could get inside their way of thinking because they all operated with a degree of rationality. But the drug fiends seemed to be dominated by their needs, and they could turn unfriendly or violent at any moment. Many dealers developed a kind of phobia of the fiends. They saw in them the weaknesses and dependence that could befall anyone who succumbed to addiction. The hustler relies on his razor-sharp mind. To even flirt with drug use could destroy such power and lead him down the slippery slope towards dependence. If he was around the fiends too much, he could become a user himself. Curtis understood this and kept his distance from them, but this aspect of hustling bothered him. On one particular occasion, the fiends were suddenly avoiding him, and he could not figure out why. All he knew was that he could not sell a batch of drugs that he had on consignment. Under such an arrangement, a higher-up source, or connect, had given him the drugs for free. Once he sold the entire lot, he would return a specified amount of the earnings to the connect and keep the rest as profit. But in this instance, it looked like he would not make nearly enough to pay back the connect. That could prove damaging to his reputation and lead to all kinds of trouble. He might have to steal to get the money. Feeling somewhat desperate, he went into full hustling mode, working night and day, offering all kinds of discounts, whatever it took to unload the drugs. He managed to make back just enough, but it was a close call. Perhaps the quality of the batch he was selling was inferior, but how could he tell beforehand? And how could he prevent this from happening again and again? One day he sought the advice of a man named Dre, an older hustler who had lasted an unusually long time dealing drugs on the streets. He was considered a sharp businessman. In prison, he had studied economics on his own, and he seemed to have an especially good rapport with the fiends. Dre explained to Curtis that in his experience, there are two kinds of hustlers in this world, those who stay on the outside and those who move to the inside. The outside types never bother to learn anything about their customers. It's just about money and numbers. They have no concept of psychology or the nuances of people's needs and demands. They're afraid of getting too close to the customer. That might force them to reassess their ideas and methods. The superior hustler moves to the inside. He's not afraid of the fiends. He wants to find out what's going on in their heads. Drug users are no different from anyone else. They have phobias and bouts of boredom and a whole inner life. Because you remain on the outside, he told Curtis, you don't see any of this, and your hustling is purely mechanical and dead. To raise your game, he explained, you have to first put into practice one of the oldest hustling tricks in the book, the tester. What this means is the following. Whenever you get a batch of drugs, you separate a portion of it to give out for free to certain fiends. They tell you right there on the spot whether the stuff is good or bad. If their feedback is positive, they will spread the word through their own networks. And such reports are so much more credible, coming from a fellow user, than reports from a hustler hyping his own stuff. If the feedback is negative, you will have to adjust and find some way to cut it to offer illusions, apparent two-for-one deals with the capsule simply loaded with dust, whatever it takes to unload it. But you must always operate with feedback on the quality of your product. Otherwise, you will not survive on these streets. Once you have this system in place, you use it to cultivate relationships with your most reliable fiends. They supply you with valuable information about any kind of change in tastes that are happening. Talking to them, you get all kinds of ideas for marketing schemes and new angles for hustling. You gain a feel for how they think. From this inside position, the whole game explodes into something creative and alive with possibility. Curtis quickly incorporated this system and soon discovered that the drug fiends were not at all as he had imagined. They became erratic only when you were not consistent in your dealings with them. They valued convenience and fast transactions, wanted something new every now and then, and loved the thought of any kind of deal. With this growing body of knowledge, he could play to their needs and manipulate their demand. He discovered something else. Spending much of their time on the streets, they were a great source of information about what was going on with the police or the weaknesses of rival hustlers. Knowing so much about the neighborhood gave him a feeling of great power. Later, he would translate the same strategy to music and his mixtape campaign on the streets of New York. Maintaining a close connection to the tastes of his fans, he would alter his music to their responses and create the kind of sound that had a visceral appeal, something they had never heard before. After the remarkable success of his first two commercial albums, Curtis, now known as 50 Cent, stood on top of the music world. But his sense of connection, so vital on the streets, was fading in this new environment he now inhabited. He was surrounded by flatterers who wanted to be in his entourage, and managers and industry people who saw in him only dollar signs. His main interactions were with people in the corporate world or other stars. He could no longer hang out on the streets or get first-hand looks at the trends that were just starting up. All of this meant that he was flying blind with his music, not really sure if it would connect anymore with his audience. They were the source of his energy and spirit, but the distance separating them was growing. Other stars seemed to not mind this. In fact, they enjoyed living in this kind of celebrity bubble. They were afraid of coming back down to Earth. 50 felt the opposite. But there seemed to be no way out. Then in early 2007, he decided to start up his own website. He thought of it as a way to market his music and merchandise directly to the public, without the screen of his record label, which was proving quite inept in adapting to the internet age. Soon this website transformed itself into a social networking site, like Facebook for his fans. And the more he delved into it, the more he began to sense that this represented much more than a marketing gimmick. It was perhaps the ultimate tool for reconnecting with his audience. First, he decided to experiment. As he prepared to launch a G-Unit record in the summer of 2008, he leaked one of the songs onto the website on a Friday night. Then the next day, he refreshed the comments page every few minutes and tracked the members' responses to it. After several hundred comments, it was clear that the verdict was negative. The song was too soft, they judged. they wanted and expected something harder from a G-Unit record. Taking their criticisms to heart, he shelved the song and soon released another, creating the hard sound they had demanded. This time, the response was overwhelmingly positive. This called for more experiments. He put up the latest single from his arch-enemy, The Game, hoping to read negative comments from his fans. To his surprise, many of them liked the song. He engaged in an online debate with them and had his eyes opened about changes in people's tastes and why they might have grown distant from his music. It forced him to rethink his own direction. To draw more people to his site, he decided to break down the distance in both directions. He posted blogs on personal subjects and then responded to his fans' comments. They could feel they had complete access to him. Using the latest advances in phone technology, he took this further, having his team film him on their cell phones wherever he went. These images were then streamed live on the website. This generated intense traffic and online chatter. Fans would never know when such moments could happen, so they were forced to check in at regular intervals to try to catch these spontaneous moments, sometimes riveting in their banality, other times made dramatic by 50s flair for confrontation. Membership grew by leaps and bounds. As it evolved, the website came to strangely resemble the world of hustling that he had created for himself on the streets of Southside, Queens. He could produce testers, trial songs, for his fans, who were like drug fiends, constantly hungry for new product from 50, and he could get instant feedback on their quality. He could develop a feel for what they were looking for and how he could manipulate their demand. He had moved from the outside to the inside, and the hustling game came alive once more, this time on a global scale. The Fearless Approach. The following is a quote from 50 Cent. "The public is never wrong. When people don't respond to what you do, they're telling you something loud and clear. You're just not listening." All living creatures depend for their survival on their relationship to their environment. If they are particularly sensitive to any kind of change, a danger, or an opportunity, they have greater power to dominate their surroundings. It is not simply that the hawk can see farther than any other creature, but that it can see great detail, picking out the slightest alteration in the landscape. Its eyes give it tremendous sensitivity and supreme hunting prowess. We live in an environment that is mostly human. It consists of the people that we interact with day in and day out. These humans come from many varied backgrounds and cultures. They are individuals with their own unique experiences. To know people well, their differences, their nuances, their emotional life, would give us a great sense of connection and power. We would know how to reach them, communicate more effectively, and influence their actions. But so often, we remain on the outside and lack this power. To connect to the environment in this way would mean having to move outside ourselves, train our eyes on people, but so often we prefer to live in our heads, amid our own thoughts and dreams. We strive to make everything in the world familiar and simple. We grow insensitive to people's differences, to the details that make them individuals. At the root of this turning inward and disconnect is a great fear, one of the most primal known to man, and perhaps the least understood. In the beginning, our primitive ancestors formed groups for protection. To create a sense of cohesion, they established all kinds of codes of behavior, taboos, and shared rituals. They also created myths in which their tribe was considered to be the favorite of the gods, chosen for some great purpose. To be a member of the tribe was to be cleansed by rituals and to be favored by the gods. Those who belonged to other groups had unfamiliar rituals and belief systems their own gods and origin myths. They were not clean. They represented the other, something dark, threatening, and a challenge to the tribe's sense of superiority. This was part of our psychological makeup for thousands upon thousands of years. It transformed itself into a great fear of other cultures and ways of thinking. For Christians, this meant all heathens. And despite millennia of civilization, it lives on within us to this day, in the form of a mental process in which we divide the world into what is familiar and unfamiliar, clean and unclean. We develop certain ideas and values. We socialize with those who share those values, who form part of our inner circle, our clique. We form factions of rigid beliefs, on the right, on the left, for this or for that. We live in our heads, with the same thoughts and ideas over and over, cocooned from the outside world. When we are confronted with people or individuals who have different values and belief systems, we feel threatened. Our first move is not to understand them, but to demonize them, that shadowy other. Alternatively, we may choose to look at them through the prism of our own values and assume they share them. We mentally convert the other into something familiar. They may come from a completely different culture, but after all, they must want the same things we do. This is a failure of our minds to move outward and understand, to be sensitive to nuance. Everything must be white or black, clean or unclean. Understand, the opposite approach is the way to power in this world. It begins with a fundamental fearlessness. You do not feel afraid or affronted by people who have different ways of thinking or acting. You do not feel superior to those on the outside. In fact, you are excited by such diversity. Your first move is to open up your spirit to these differences, to understand what makes the other tick, to gain a feel for people's inner lives, how they see the world. In this way, you continually expose yourself to wider and wider circles of people, building connections to these various networks. The source of your power is your sensitivity and closeness to this social environment. You can detect trends and changes in people's tastes well before anyone else. In the hood, conditions are more crowded than elsewhere. People with all kinds of different psychologies are constantly in your face. Any power you have depends on your ability to know everything that is going on around you, to be sensitive to changes, aware of the power structures that are imposed from without and within. There is no time or room to escape to some inner dreamland. You have a sense of urgency to stay connected to the environment and the people around you. Your life depends on it. We now live in similar conditions. All kinds of people of divergent cultures and psychologies are thrown together. But because we live in a society of more apparent abundance and ease, we lack that sense of urgency to connect to other people. This is dangerous. In such a melting pot as the modern world, with people's tastes changing at a faster pace than ever before, our success depends on our ability to move outside ourselves and connect to other social networks. At all costs, you need to continually force yourself outward. You must reach a point where any sense of losing this connection to your environment translates into a feeling of vulnerability and peril. In the end, this primal fear of ours translates into a mental infirmity, the closing of the mind to any ideas that are new and unfamiliar. The fearless types in history learn to develop the opposite, an open spirit, a mind that is constantly learning from experience. Look at the example of the great British primatologist Jane Goodall, whose field research revolutionized our ideas on chimpanzees and primates. Prior to Goodall's work, Scientists had established certain accepted ideas on how to do research on animals such as chimpanzees. They were mostly to be studied in cages, under very controlled circumstances. On occasion, primatologists would research them in the wild. They would come up with various tricks to lure the chimpanzees closer to them, while remaining hidden behind some kind of protective screen. They would conduct experiments by manipulating the animals and noting their responses. The goal was to come up with general truths about chimpanzee behavior. Only by keeping their distance from the animals could the scientists study them. Goodall did not have any formal training in the sciences when she arrived in 1960 in what is now known as Tanzania to study chimpanzees in the wild. Operating totally on her own, she devised a radically different means of research. The chimps lived in the remotest parts of the country and were notoriously shy. She tracked them from a distance, patiently working to gain their trust. She dressed inconspicuously and was careful to not look them in the eye. When she noticed they were uncomfortable with her being in the area, she moved away, or acted like a baboon that was merely there digging for insects. Slowly, over the course of several months, she was able to move closer and closer. Now she could begin to identify individual chimps that she kept seeing. She gave them names, something scientists had never done before. They had always been designated by numbers. With these names, she could begin to detect subtle nuances in their individual behavior. They had different personalities, like humans. After nearly a year of this patient seduction, the chimps began to relax in her presence and allow her to interact with them, something no one had ever achieved before in the history of studying primates in the wild. This took a tremendous degree of courage, as chimpanzees were considered the most volatile of the primates, more dangerous and violent than gorillas. As she interacted with them more and more, she noticed a change in herself as well. "I think my mind works like a chimp's, subconsciously," she wrote a friend. She felt this because she had developed an uncanny ability to find them in the forest. Now, gaining access to them, she took note of several phenomena that belied the accepted data on chimpanzee behavior. Scientists had cataloged the animals as vegetarians. She observed them hunting and eating monkeys. Only humans were considered capable of making and using tools. She saw them crafting elaborate instruments to catch insects for food. She saw them engage in bizarre dance rituals during a rainstorm. She later observed a horrific war that went on for 4 years between rival packs. She cataloged some rather strange Machiavellian behavior among the males who fought for supremacy. All in all, she revealed a degree of variety in their emotional and intellectual lives that altered the concept not only of chimpanzees, but also of all primates and mammals. This has great application beyond the realms of science. Normally, when you study something, you begin with certain preconceived notions about the subject. Because scientists had come to believe that chimpanzees had a limited range of behavior, that is all that they saw, missing the much more complex reality. Your mind begins the process in a closed state, not really sensitive to difference and nuance. You are afraid of having your assumptions challenged. Instead, like Goodall, you must let go of this need to control and narrow your field of vision. When you study an individual or a group, your goal is to get inside their minds, their experiences, their way of looking at things. To do this, you must interact with them on a more equal plane. With this open and fearless spirit, you will discover things no one had suspected before. You will have a much deeper appreciation for the targets of your actions or the public you are trying to reach. And with such understanding will come the power to move them. Keys to Fearlessness. The following is a quote from François de La Rochefoucauld. Few people have the wisdom to prefer the criticism that would do them good to the praise that deceives them. In the work that we produce for business or for culture, there is always a telling moment when it leaves our hands and reaches the public for which it was intended. In that instant, it ceases to be something that was in our heads. It becomes an object that is judged by others. Sometimes this object connects with people in a profound way. It strikes an emotional chord, resonates, and has warmth. It meets a need. Other times, it leaves people surprisingly cold. In our minds, we had imagined it having a much different effect. This process can seem rather mysterious. Some people seem to have a knack for creating things that resonate with an audience. They are great artists, politicians with a popular touch, or business people who are endlessly inventive. Sometimes we ourselves produce something that works, but we fail to understand why. And lacking this knowledge, we cannot reproduce our success. There is an aspect to this phenomenon, however, that is explicable. Anything we create or produce is for a public, large or small, depending on what we do. If we are the type that lives mostly in our heads, imagining what the intended public will like, or not even caring, this spirit is reproduced in the work itself. It is disconnected from the social environment. It is a product of a person who is wrapped up in him or herself. If, on the other hand, we are deeply connected to the public, if we have a profound sense of their needs and wants, then what we make tends to resonate. We have internalized the way of thinking and feeling of our audience, and it shows in the work. The great Russian writer Fyodor Dostoevsky had almost two separate parts to his career. In the first, he was a socialist who interacted mostly with other intellectuals. His novels and stories were relatively successful. But then, in 1849, he was sentenced to several years of prison and hard labor in Siberia for ostensibly conspiring against the government. There, he suddenly discovered that he hadn't known the Russian people at all. In prison, he was thrown in among the dregs of society. In the small village where he did his hard labor, he finally mingled with the Russian peasantry that dominated the country. Once he was freed, all of these experiences became deeply embedded in his work, and suddenly his novels resonated far beyond intellectual circles. He understood his public, the mass of Russian people, from the inside, and his work became immensely popular. Understand, you cannot disguise your attitude towards the public. If you feel superior at all, part of some chosen elite, then this seeps out in the work. It is conveyed in the tone and mood. It feels patronizing. If you have little access to the public you are trying to reach, but you feel that the ideas in your head cannot fail to be interesting, then it almost inevitably comes across as something too personal, the product of someone who is alienated. In either case, what is really dominating the spirit of your work is fear. To interact closely with the public and get its feedback might mean having to adjust your brilliant ideas, your preconceived notions. This might challenge your tidy vision of the world. You might disguise this with a snobbish veneer, but it is the age-old fear of the other. We are social creatures who make things in order to communicate and connect with those around us. Your goal must be to break down the distance between you and your audience, the base of your support in life. Some of this distance is mental. It comes from your ego and the need to feel superior. Some of it is physical. The nature of your business tends to shut you off from the public with layers of bureaucracy. In any event, what you are seeking is maximum interaction, allowing you to get a feel for people from the inside. You come to thrive off their feedback and criticism. Operating this way, what you produce will not fail to resonate, because it will come from the inside. This deep level of interaction is the source of the most powerful and popular works in culture and business, and a political style that truly connects. The following are four strategies you can use to bring yourself closer to this ideal. crush all distance. The French artist Henri de Toulouse-Lautrec came from one of the oldest aristocratic bloodlines in France, but from early on he felt estranged from his family. Part of this came from his physical handicap. His legs had stopped growing at the age of 14, giving him a dwarfish appearance. Part of it came from his sensitive nature. He turned to painting as his only interest in life, and in 1882, at the age of 18, he moved to Paris to study with a famous artist whose studio was in Montmartre, the bohemian and somewhat seedy part of the city. There, Toulouse-Lautrec discovered a whole new world. The cafes and dance halls frequented by prostitutes, con artists, dancers, street performers, and all the shady characters who found themselves drawn to this quartier. Perhaps because of his own alienation from his family, he identified with these outcasts. And slowly he began to immerse himself deeper and deeper in the social life of Montmartre. He befriended the prostitutes and hired them as models, seeking to capture the essence of their lives on canvas. He returned to the dance halls often and sketched while he watched. He drank with the criminal types and the anarchist agitators who passed through the neighborhood. He absorbed every aspect of this world, including the habits of the rich people who came to the area for entertainment and to slum it. Other painters like Degas and Renoir, who both lived in Montmartre, painted many scenes of life there, but it was always with a sense of distance, as if they were outsiders peeking in. Toulouse-Lautrec was more of an active participant, and as his drawings and paintings began to reflect this immersion, his work drew more attention from the public. All of this culminated in the posters that he did for the dance hall the Moulin Rouge, which opened in 1889. The first and most famous one of all was a scandalous image of a dancer kicking so high you can see her underwear. The colors are intense and garish. But strangest of all is the kind of flat space he created, which gives viewers the sensation that they are there on stage with the performers, in the middle of all the activity and bright lights. No one had created anything quite like it before. When the poster was placed all over the city, people were mesmerized by the image. It seemed to vibrate with a life of its own. More and more posters followed of all the figures in the Moulin Rouge whom he came to know on intimate terms, and an entire new aesthetic was forged around his complete democratic mingling with his subjects. His work became immensely popular. Understand, in this day and age, to reach people you must have access to their inner lives, their frustrations, aspirations, resentments. To do so, you must crush as much distance as possible between you and your audience. You enter their spirit and absorb it from within. Their way of looking at things becomes yours, and when you recreate it in some form of work, it has life. What shocks and excites you will then have the same effect on them. This requires a degree of fearlessness and an open spirit. You are not afraid to have your whole personality shaped by these intense interactions. You assume a radical equality with the public, giving voice to people's ideas and desires. What you produce will naturally connect in a deep way. Open informal channels of criticism and feedback. When Eleanor Roosevelt entered the White House as the First Lady in 1933, it was with much trepidation. She had a disdain for conventional politics and for the kind of cliquish attitude it fostered. In her mind, her husband's power would depend on his connection to the people who had elected him. To get out of the Depression, the public had to feel engaged in the struggle, not merely be seduced by speeches and programs. When people feel involved, they bring their own ideas and energy to the cause. Her fear was that the bureaucratic nature of government would swallow up her husband. He would come to listen to his cabinet members and experts. His contact with the public would be relegated to formal channels such as reports, polls, and studies. This isolation would spell his doom, cutting him off from his base of support. Denied an official position within the administration, she decided to work to create informal channels to the public on her own. She traveled all over the country, to inner cities and remote rural towns, listening to people's complaints and needs. She brought many of these people back to meet the president to give him first-hand impressions of the effects of the New Deal. She started a column in the Woman's Home Companion, in which she had posted above the headline, quote, "I want you to write me." She would use her column as a kind of discussion forum with the American public, encouraging people to share their criticisms. Within 6 months, she had received over 300,000 letters, and with her staff, she worked to answer every last one of them. She opened other channels of communication, for instance, planting her aides in various New Deal programs, who would then poll on her behalf the public affected by these programs. With this system in place, she began to see a pattern from the bottom up, a growing disenchantment with the New Deal. Every day, she left a memo in her husband's basket, reminding him of these criticisms and the need to be more responsive. And slowly she began to have an influence on his policy, pushing him leftward. For instance, getting him to create programs such as the NYA, the National Youth Administration, which would involve young people actively in the New Deal. Over time, she became the unofficial channel of communication for women's groups and African Americans, shoring up FDR's support in these two key constituencies. All of this work took tremendous courage, for she was continually ridiculed for her activist approach, long before any First Lady had ever thought of taking such a role. And her work played a major part in FDR's ability to maintain his image as a man of the people. As Eleanor understood, any kind of group tends to close itself off from the outside world. It is easier to operate this way. From within this bubble, people will delude themselves into thinking they have insight into how their audience or public feels. They read the papers, various reports, the poll numbers, etc. But all of this information tends to be flat and highly filtered. It is much different when you interact directly with the public and hear in the flesh their criticisms and feedback. You discover what lies at the root of their discontent, the various nuances of how your work affects them. Their problems come to life, and any solutions you come up with have more relevance. You create a back-and-forth dynamic in which their ideas, involvement, and energy could be harnessed for your purposes. If some distance between you and the public must be maintained by the nature of your group or enterprise, then the ideal is to open up as many informal channels as possible, getting your feedback straight from the source. Reconnect with your base. We see the following occur over and over. A person has success when they are younger because they have deep ties with a social group. What they produce and say comes from a real place and connects with an audience. Then slowly they lose this connection. Success creates distance. They come to spend most of their time with other successful people. Consciously or unconsciously, they come to feel separated and above their audience. The intensity in their work is gone, and with it, any kind of real effect on the public. In his own way, the famous black activist Malcolm X struggled with this problem. He had spent his youth as a savvy street hustler, ending up in prison on drug charges. There, he discovered the religion of Islam, as practiced by the Nation of Islam, and immediately converted. Out of prison, he became a highly visible spokesperson for the group. Eventually, he broke off from the Nation of Islam and transformed himself into a leading figure in the growing Black Power movement of the 1960s. In these various phases of his life, Malcolm felt intense anger and frustration at the levels of injustice for African Americans, much of which he had experienced firsthand. He channeled these emotions into powerful speeches, seeming to give voice to the anger that many felt who lived deep within the ghettos of America. But as he became more and more famous, he felt some anxiety. Other leaders in the black community that he had known had begun to live fairly well. They could not help but feel some distance and superiority to those they were supposed to represent, like a father caring for a child. Malcolm hated that feeling of creeping paternalism, In his mind, people can only help themselves. His role was to inspire them to action, not act in their name. To inoculate himself against this psychic distance, he increased his interactions with street hustlers and agitators, the kind of people from the lower depths that most leaders would scrupulously avoid. Those from the heart of the ghetto were his power base, and he had to reconnect with them. He made himself spend more time with those who had suffered recent injustices, soaking up their experiences and sense of outrage. Most people mellow with age. He would retain his anger, the intensity of emotions that had impelled him in the first place and given him his charisma. The goal in connecting to the public is not to please everyone or to spread yourself out to the widest possible audience. Communication is a power of intensity, not extensity and numbers. In trying to widen your appeal, you will substitute quantity for quality, and you will pay a price. You have a base of power, a group of people, small or large, which identifies with you. This base is also mental, ideas you had when you were younger, which were tied to powerful emotions and inspired you to take a particular path. Time and success tend to diffuse the sense of connection you have to this physical and mental base. You will drift, and your powers of communication will diminish. Know your base and work to reconnect with it. Keep your associations with it alive, intense, and present. Return to your origins, the source of all inspiration and power. Create the social mirror. Alone, in our minds, we can imagine we have all kinds of powers and abilities. Our egos can inflate to any size. But when we produce something that fails to have the expected impact, we are suddenly faced with a limit. We are not as brilliant or skilled as we had imagined. In such a case, our tendency is to blame others for not understanding it or getting in our way. Our egos are bruised and delicate. Criticism from the outside seems like a personal attack, which we cannot endure. We tend to close ourselves off, and this makes it doubly difficult to succeed with our next venture. Instead of turning inward, consider people's coolness to your idea and their criticisms as a kind of mirror they are holding up to you. A physical mirror turns you into an object. You can see yourself as others see you. Your ego cannot protect you. The mirror does not lie. You use it to correct your appearance and avoid ridicule. The opinions of other people serve a similar function. You view your work from inside your mind, encrusted with all kinds of desires and fears. They see it as an object. They see it as it is. Through their criticisms, you can get closer to this objective version and gradually improve what you do. One caveat: beware of feedback from friends whose judgments could be tainted by feelings of envy or the need to flatter. When your work does not communicate with others, consider it your own fault. You did not make your ideas clear enough, and you failed to connect with your audience emotionally. This will spare you any bitterness or anger that might come from people's critiques. You are simply perfecting your work through the social mirror. Reversal of perspective. Science and the scientific method are very powerful and practical pursuits of knowledge that have come to dominate much of our thinking for the past few centuries. But they have also spawned a peculiar preconception that to understand anything, we must study it from a distance and with a detached perspective. For example, we tend to judge a book that is full of statistics and quotes from various studies as carrying more weight because it seems to have that requisite scientific objectivity and distance. Science, however, often deals with matter that is inorganic or has a marginal emotional life. Studying such things from a detached perspective makes sense and yields profound results. But this does not translate so well when dealing with people and creatures who respond from an emotional core. The knowledge of what makes them tick on the inside is missing. To study them from the outside is merely a prejudice, often one stemming from fear. Dealing with people's experiences and subjectivity is messy and chaotic. Distance is cleaner and easier. It is time to reevaluate this preconception and see things from the opposite perspective. Knowledge of human nature and social factors, the kind that is often most valuable to us, depends on knowing people and networks from the inside, on getting a feel for what they are experiencing. This can best be gained by an intense involvement and participation, as opposed to the pseudo-scientific pose of the intellectual, addicted to studies, citations, and numbers, all designed to back up their preconceptions. This other form of knowledge, from the inside, must be the one that you come to esteem above all others in social matters. It is what will give you power to affect people. To the extent that you feel yourself to be distant and on the outside, you must tell yourself you do not understand what you are studying or trying to reach. You are missing the mark, and there is work to be done. The following is a quote from Baron de Montesquieu. A really intelligent man feels what other men only know.
Chapter 8. Respect the process. Mastery. The fools in life want things fast and easy. Money, success, attention. Boredom is their great enemy and fear. Whatever they manage to get slips through their hands as fast as it comes in. You, on the other hand, want to outlast your rivals. You are building the foundation for something that can continue to expand. To make this happen, you will have to serve an apprenticeship. You must learn early on to endure the hours of practice and drudgery, knowing that in the end, all of that time will translate into a higher pleasure. Mastery of a craft and of yourself. Your goal is to reach the ultimate skill level, an intuitive feel for what must come next.
Slow money. The following is a quote from Charlie Parker. Master the instrument, master the music, then forget all that shit and play. Growing up in Southside, Queens, the only people Curtis Jackson could see who had any money and power were the street hustlers. So at the age of 11, and with big dreams for the future, he chose just such a path for himself. Almost immediately, however, he saw that the life of a hustler was not glamorous at all. It consisted mostly of standing on a street corner day after day, selling the same stuff to the same fiends. It meant enduring hours with nothing to do, waiting for customers to come by, often in the bitter cold or the blistering heat. And in those long, tedious hours on the streets, Curtis's mind naturally would wander. He would find himself wishing for money that would come faster and easier, with more excitement. There were opportunities for this in the hood. They mostly involved crime or some dubious scheme. Sometimes he would feel tempted to try them, but in such moments he would remind himself of the endless stories of the hustlers he had known who had fallen for the illusion of fast, easy money. All suckers who inevitably ended up dead or broke. There was his friend T.C., who got tired of hustling and fell in with a crew that would spend the summer robbing convenience stores, and occasionally a bank. He made quite a haul of money over those 3 months, and then blew it all over the fall and winter. The following summer, he was back at it again. It wasn't just the money. It was the thrill that came in flirting with so much danger. But that second summer, his luck ran out, and he was killed in a gunfight with the police. There was Curtis's colleague, Spite, a few years older, who had managed to save some money from his hustling, but had dreams of something much bigger. He convinced himself he could make a fortune fast by buying a piece of a franchise business that was new to the hood, but that he felt was certain to be hot. He poured all of his money into the venture, but he was too impatient. He had not taken the time to accustom the public to his new life. Everyone believed the business was just a front for some drug operation. They avoided it, and it soon became a hangout for hustlers and fiends. It failed within a few months, and he never recovered from the experience. This was the gist of the problem. To be a successful hustler, you had to accustom yourself to the slow, grinding pace of the job. But in the hood, the future rarely seemed promising. It was hard for hustlers to imagine saving their money for some rainy day in the future, when that day would probably never come. Inevitably, the desire for something faster would creep into their blood, and if they gave in, they created a cycle they could never escape. If they were able to get some fast money, it would act like a drug. They would get excited and spend it all on items to impress people. With no money left, they would return to dealing drugs, but now it seemed too slow and boring. They would try again for something fast. They became trapped by their own greed, and as the years went by, they would fail to develop any kind of patience or discipline. They could not manage this up-and-down pace for too long. By the age of 25 or 30, they would burn themselves out and have no skills or money to show for their years of work. Their fate after that was generally unpleasant. To resist this temptation, Curtis decided he would force himself in the opposite direction. He treated hustling as a job. He showed up on the street corner at the same hour every day, working from dawn to dusk. Gradually, he accustomed himself to the slow pace. During the long hours with nothing to do, he would contemplate the future and come up with detailed plans of what he would accomplish year by year, ending with his eventual escape from street hustling. He would move into music and then into business. To take the first step, he would have to save his money. The thought of this goal helped him endure the daily tedium of the job. In these slow hours, he also devised new hustling schemes with the idea of continually improving himself at this job. He took up boxing to discipline his mind and body. He was terrible at first, but he was tenacious, training day in and day out, eventually becoming a skilled fighter. This taught him invaluable lessons. He could get whatever he wanted through sheer persistence rather than by violence or force. Progressing step by step was the only way to succeed in anything. By the age of 20, he made his break into music, all according to his original plan. In 1999, after a few years of apprenticing with Jam Master Jay, Curtis, now known as 50 Cent, signed a deal with Columbia Records. It seemed like a dream come true, but as he looked around at the other rappers who had been at the label a little longer, he saw the dangers around him had only increased. The tendency, as he saw it, was to immediately let up in your energy and focus. Rappers would feel that they had arrived, and unconsciously they wouldn't work as hard and would spend less time learning their craft. That sudden influx of money would go to their heads. They would imagine that they had the golden touch and could keep it coming. One hit song or record would make this even worse. Not building something slowly, a career, a future, it would all fall apart within a few years as younger and more eager rappers would take their place. Their life would be all the more miserable for having once tasted some glory. To Curtis, the solution was simple. This was a new world he had entered. He had to take his time and learn it well. In the fast environment of hip-hop, he would slow everything down. He avoided the partying and kept mostly to himself. He decided to treat Columbia Records as a university, his one chance to educate himself in the business. He would record his music at night and spend the entire day at the Columbia offices, talking shop to people in every division. Gradually, he taught himself more and more about marketing and distribution and the nuts and bolts of the business. He studied all aspects of production, what went into making a hit song. He practiced his music over and over. When the label sent him and dozens of other rappers to a retreat in upstate New York to write songs, he returned with 36 tracks, while most of the others could barely muster 5 or 6. In the wake of the assassination attempt on 50 in 2000, Columbia Records dropped him from the label, but by then he had outgrown his need for their expertise. He had accumulated so much knowledge and skill that he was able to apply it all to his mixtape campaign, creating songs at an insane pace and marketing his music as smartly as any professional. Step by step he advanced, the campaign gaining the attention of Eminem, who signed him to his label at Interscope in 2003. Years later, he found himself in the corporate world, and he quickly discovered it was not much different from the streets. So many of the business people and executives he met had that same level of impatience. They could only think in terms of months or weeks. Their relationship to money was emotional, a way to impose their importance and feed their ego. They would come to him with schemes that seemed intriguing in the present, but that led nowhere down the road. They were not attuned to the immense changes going on in the world and planning to exploit them in the future. That would take too much effort and time. These business types came at him from all directions with endorsement deals that would make him some fast millions. They assumed he was like all the other rappers who grabbed at such opportunities. But endorsement deals would not help him build anything solid or real. It was illusion money. He would turn them down, opting to start his own businesses on his own terms, each business building on the other like links on a chain. The goal this time was simple, to forge an empire that would last. And as before, he would get there through his own grinding persistence. The Fearless Approach. The following is a quote from 50 Cent. "Most people can't handle boredom. That means they can't stay on one thing until they get good at it, and they wonder why they're unhappy." For our most primitive ancestors, life was a constant struggle, entailing endless labor to secure food and shelter. If there was any free time, it generally was reserved for rituals that would give meaning to such a hard life. Then, over thousands of years of civilization, life gradually became easier for many. And with that came more and more free time. In such moments, there was no need to work the fields or worry about enemies or the elements. Just an expanse of hours to somehow fill. And suddenly, a new emotion was born into this world. Boredom. At work or in rituals, the mind would be filled with various tasks to accomplish. But alone in one's house, this free time would allow the mind to roam wherever it wanted. Confronted with such freedom, the mind has a tendency to gravitate towards anxieties about the future, possible problems and dangers. Such empty time faintly echoes the internal emptiness of death itself. And so with this new emotion that assailed our ancestors came a desire that haunts us to this day, to escape boredom at all cost, to distract ourselves from these anxieties. The principal means of distraction are all forms of public entertainment, drugs and alcohol, and social activities. But such distractions have a drug-like effect. They wear off. We crave new ones, faster ones, to lift us out of ourselves and divert us from the harsh realities of life and creeping boredom. An entire civilization, ancient Rome, practically collapsed under the weight of this new need and emotion. Their economy became tied to the creation of novel luxuries and entertainments that sapped its citizens' spirit. Few were willing anymore to sacrifice their pleasures for hard work or the public good. This is the pattern that boredom has created for the human animal ever since. We look outside ourselves for diversions and grow dependent on them. These entertainments have a faster pace than the time we spend at work. Work, then, is experienced as something boring, slow, and repetitive. Anything challenging, requiring effort, is viewed the same way. It's not fun. It's not fast. If we go far enough in this direction, we find it increasingly difficult to muster the patience to endure the hard work that is required for mastering any kind of craft. It becomes harder to spend time alone. Life becomes divided between what is necessary, time at work, and what is pleasurable, distractions and entertainment. In the past, these extremes of boredom assailed mostly those in the upper classes. Now it is something that plagues almost all of us. There is, however, another possible relationship to boredom